You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Tuesday Home Time with Joan Bartlett. 2 hours of current affairs until 6pm when we hear from Done By Law, presented by the Federation of Community Legal Centres. And thanks to Anne McAllister for her Celtic Folk Show. And today, it's the 1st of July. We hear from Dr. Helen McHugh, AM, about the great victory for journalist and broadcaster Antoinette Latouf over the ABC and the Zionist movement. Dr. Colin Hughes, Western Australian representative for IPAN, about the preemptive strike on Iran and much more. Part two of the webinar featuring Ahmed Alabadi, Wendy Bacon and Yaakov Abren on the impact of Zionism in Australia with the media and politicians. And finally, Associate Professor Tilman Ruff looking at what now could be the greatest threat to the world rather than climate crisis, the threat of nuclear war. But first, let's hear from Mr. Kevin Healy and his week that was.
A week, Jan, listener, when US of the UN of the US of the world, Big Supremo Donald Trump or the poor, made yet another huge bid for the Nobel Peace Prize by bombing the proverbial out of evil Iran, obliterating its nuclear facilities or just causing a little bit of damage, depending who we believe. But seeing Donald and his lot say obliterate, we know who to believe. And then Donald headed for the NATO war fest where they capitulated to his demands on behalf of the merchants of death, and they called him Daddy, which he took as a compliment because they loved me, the greatest love ever, ever. Although maybe it was because they knew he'd screwed them, and then there was a ceasefire, and the Zion being offensive and train-killing minister said evil Iran had broken the ceasefire by firing rockets which had been intercepted, and therefore poor Zion had no choice but to continue bombing the proverbial out of evil Iran, and evil Iran denied it had fired any rockets, and given Zion's record of reliability again, we know who to believe. And when for once our big Supremo Anthony Albanese and Minister for going overseas all the time and being a perfectly good little prefect, Penny Left Wing, took a whole day to join the applause for Donald's Peace Prize trained killing, our media and the caring business class party hayseed and sheepshit coalition attacked them for being weak, because obviously we must instantly support our Lord and Master. And then the caring business class shadowy minister who loves being offensive and trained killing, Andrew Hastie to battle, himself a former big-time trained killer in the SAS. They're the ones, the cream of true blue Aussie youth, brave young men and women in uniform, love their families and dear little children, who train to kill with a little finger. Why, that cream of true blue Aussie, brave young, loves his Ben Roberts, smite them, was one of them, declared war criminal by a defamation hearing, we bet he regrets big time. Anyway, Andrew said with US of bases and train killers and train killing merchandise and train killing infrastructure like Pine Cap growing exponentially in true blue Aussie, just perhaps we should have some guidelines to ensure true blue Aussie retains a little bit of independence on all this. Okay, let's forget this is the first time we've heard the caring business class coalition not have the slightest concern about true blue Aussie independence from the US of. But our very own great socialist minister for being offensive and train killing, Richard Malls, the bad guys, brilliantly put Hastie to battle in his place. We already have a level of transparency. Richard cleared that one up. Oh, yes. How does it work, Richard? Well, they tell us what to do, and we do it. As the US of merchants of death vacuum billions of the true blue Aussie public purse into their bloodstained coffers, the mainstream media and the coalition attack poor Anthony for being ignored by Donald. Anthony thinking it politically wiser to stay away rather than be stubbed again, but his sidekick Richard was hoping he would meet Donald at the NATO war fest, but no. Once again, Donald took off with nary a thought for our Richard, although we would have thought people would be queuing up and going out of their way to make sure they don't meet Donald. But if it had taken place, Donald and the fawning acolyte Richard, wouldn't that be a meeting of the minds? Thanks to the great practitioners of the greatest little economic order in them all and their sundry chambers of profits, we know what's needed to get the greatest little rolling along again. Productivity from lazy avaricious workers, / red tape, more crucially, / green tape, environmental delays, unnecessary delays, when everyone knows whatever it is the long-haired, greeny, commie environmentalists are concerned about will get approved anyway. / enterprise, stifling corporate taxes and taxes on the filthy rich, increase corporate welfare from the public purse, from the taxes they don't pay, while preventing the deadening hand of the public sector, also stifling that enterprise. Simplify crippling, caring business class relations laws to allow caring employers and lazy, avaricious workers to reach mutually acceptable agreements on wages and conditions on an equal footing without the interference of evil unions in what is none of the union's business. Scrap these same job, same pay laws, for instance, which are hurting many of our great corporate citizens. Oh, and to balance those corporate and filthy rich tax cuts, increase the GST and remove all exemptions. Much fairer, because as we've stressed, the poorest of the poor can feel really important and appreciated, knowing they are paying tax at the same rate as the filthiest rich of the filthy rich, if the filthy rich paid any, which they don't. But here's a major threat. Big economic guru Jim Chalmers Capital says he won't rule out increasing the GST, but oh dear, he's inclined not to. Jim, what can be more socialist than the poor being elevated to an equal footing with the filthy rich? The matter will be discussed at Anthony and Jim's Productivity Roundtable with caring business and uncaring evil unions et al., whose not-so-secret agenda has been exposed by one of our favourites, former caring business class party MP and biographer of former big Supremo little Johnny Howhard, Prude Gohard on workers. Her regular True Blue Aussie Capitalist Review feature article, this time headlined, "Is Labor's IR Summit a Union Power Grab?" Thank goodness we've got Prude to warn us about these damaging threats to our very existence. The headline ends with a question mark, but Prude knows, and we know, there is no question about it. It's a socialist plot aimed at fooling the poor, caring business class. And I always like to point out that that little Johnny 700-plus pages tome, co-written with her husband, has sold all of 20 copies nationwide. Yet bringing people the news you don't want them to know, like popular crap, and not bringing people the news you don't want them to know, like the truth, is obviously costly. And Lord Rupert of Wapping's News Very Limited has just extended its True Blue Aussie CEO Robert Thompson's real name, by the way, tenure, for another 5 years. Interesting, the Capitalist Review, a rival media outlet, declared him the highest paid True Blue Aussie CEO at $41 million. Told you it's expensive. Yet the Lord Rupert of Wapping Sin report didn't mention his modest little salary, but told us the really important things like creating exceptional shareholder value, strategic investments, the really important things of life. Must check if anyone at this media behemoth 3CR is taking home $41 million a year, plus presumably benefits, and of course, Robert would be meeting his legal tax obligations. Bringing us to a timely word of warning from a leading tax lawyer whose role is to ensure the great corporate and filthy rich clients meet their legal tax obligations. After a Jim Chalmers Capital thought bubble that he may look at tightening laws around family trusts, which many ignorant observers allege are but vehicles for the filthy rich to evade or, meet their legal tax obligations. The big end of town lawyer pointing out that if Jim went too far, like, say, forcing them in meeting their legal tax obligations to, heaven forbid, actually pay some, would risk pushing investment, talent and wealth offshore. Wouldn't that be be a disaster. So, ignorant people, stop criticising these legal entities as some sort of tax dodge. They're simply keeping investment, talent and wealth right here in True Blue Aussie. But spare a thought for poor Jeff Bagshot. Well, not absolutely poor. He's one of the filthiest rich on the planet. And his bride-to-be, Lauren, who were forced to transfer their three-day wedding extravaganza to a less prestigious little spot in Venice due to the selfish locals complaining about the takeover of their city, the unkindest cut of all. Well, that was Rome, but never mind, same country. A huge sign in St. Mark's Square, Piazza San Marco, where all the private jets bringing in the filthiest rich of and the A set to enjoy 3 days of celebrations could see it. If you can rent Venice for your wedding, you can pay more tax. Poor Jeff, poor Lauren, how cruel. Still, imagine the in-depth conversations at the celebrations, especially by the third day, and their empathy for the non-filthy rich. Why, they'd probably even mention all they do for charity. Jeff could probably assuage the hurt from those cruel, heartless Venetians by reassuring himself that while the filthiest rich are and the glamorous A-set are enjoying the high life, the human robots in his packing houses are ensuring the trillions keep rolling in. And content that the private jets and AI in his packing houses are doing their bit for the planet. Finally, as another filthy rich, Elon must have Moore's publicly funded private campaign to shoot people off to Mars and the moon, thwarted by his rockets getting just off the ground and bang, a ball of very expensive fire. Well, his latest test attempt didn't even get off the ground before it blew to smithereens. Won't that encourage volunteers to queue up to get on board? Good afternoon.
Comrades, friends, siblings all over this continent, I urge every one of you to join us in Canberra. I refuse to be silent while Gaza is being annihilated. History will judge us all. No one will be able to say they didn't know, that they didn't see, that they didn't hear. The screams and pain are reaching every one of us from the screens we hold in our hands. Now is the time to act. July 20. I urge, I beg each and every one of you, each person of good conscience, to stand with us in Canberra. Together we can send this simple, clear message. The Albanese government must sanction Israel now. When governments fail, responsibility falls upon the citizenry to act. If we don't stand up now, then when? Join us in Canberra, July 20. It's time for the Albanese government to sanction Israel.
People tasted freedom, soon those hellish skies turn to blue and starry nights as our voices start to rise. We're ending an apartheid.
Journalist and broadcaster Antoinette Latouf took on the ABC and won. A big victory for freedom of expression. It's patently clear that when the issue is the Zionist regime in Israel, freedom of expression in its many forms, not just here in Australia, but in many Western countries, is under increasing threats. I spoke on Saturday with Helen McHugh, founder of Unionate Abroad, a feeder, and a lifelong advocate for Palestine. Helen, you, like many other, would have followed the case brought against the ABC by Antoinette. Take us back to 2023.
In October 23 was when the Hamas attacked the areas on the border of Israel, invaded Israel, actually, and committed war crimes. But it followed 17 years of occupation. And 17 years, the Israelis had completely control over food resources, calculating an average of around 1,000 calories a day per person, which meant that people were not getting sufficient nutrition other than what they could grow for themselves and could afford as well. So Israel then invaded Gaza and started to carry out some pretty horrendous war crimes against civilians. And so at that stage, by December, I'm sure it was the Human Rights Watch, or had already come out with a statement, saying, with a report rather, saying that Israel was committing war crimes. And at that stage as well, they were also starting to limit the supply of food. They were definitely starting to limit the supply of food. Latouf was employed on a contractual basis, I understand, with the ABC. And she just reposted what the Human Rights Watch material had said about that, you know, Israel was using starvation as a weapon of war. I think that's the post that she said, that she responded to, at which time the Israeli lobby in Sydney went into overdrive and the ABC crumbled under their viciousness. And in particular, it was Ida Butros was a chair, and the manager themselves, both of whom then, as I didn't follow the courts exactly, but it became very obvious during the court procedure that both the leadership of the ABC had in fact taken action against her on the basis of the pro-Israeli lobby here in Australia. And fortunately, after a long and expensive trial, Judge Daryl Rankull, I think is how you pronounce his name, concluded that the ABC had contravened the Fair Work Act when they terminated her for, and I'm quoting, he said, terminated her for reasons including that she held political opinions opposing the Israeli military campaign in Gaza. As a consequence, she took them to court, and that was the ruling last week. But as Greg Barnes wrote in an article in Pearls and Irritations, one of the reasons that this action took place against her is that we have very weak human rights laws in Australia. We don't have a Human Rights Act, and as a consequence, they were able to do that. But the outcome of it is that she's got a compensation. I think it's $70,000 or $77,000, and then she'll also, they're going to go back and sue for costs, as I understand. But in the meantime, of course, there've been an enormous number of other people who have lost their jobs, have been intimidated by this very vicious pro-Israeli lobby, including Halil Sabazi, who was on a commission with Creative Australia to represent Australia at the 2026 Venice Biennale. And also the Melbourne-Sydney Orchestra terminated the contract of Jason Gillham after his comment about a number of journalists who'd been killed in Gaza. And then there are numerous cases of universities also taking action against students and lecturers. So this case is actually a very important case, but not everybody is going to have the resources to be able to take either a university or Creative Australia or Melbourne Symphony Orchestra to court over their termination.
Antoinette didn't say anything on air, did she? This was her social media postage. Does the ABC say that you can't have a life outside the ABC?
Well, not if you're wanting to support Palestine, by the sound of it, yes. And I know also from people who've worked in the ABC that the Israeli lobby is particularly vicious and brutal, and they don't give up. They just go on and on and on and on and on because they can. And also because we've allowed it to happen, it's the problem.
It's interesting too, we're talking about students and artists, but this one I saw going through different stories that was about a veteran cricket reporter, Peter Layla. He was removed from a radio station, SEN Radio Network, for speaking out against the conflict in Gaza. So even the, I'd say the media, the right-wing media, I can imagine a national sporting radio station's not too far to the left, and he got the sack too.
The most important thing is that she had the courage and tenacity and determination and support to go through and take this to court. There's now been a judgment, and that'll make it a little bit easier for other people, because the judgment basically says is that under the Fair Work Act, you cannot be discriminated against on the basis of your political views.
Then there's the issue of Mary Costakidis, who's been taken to the Human Rights Commission, is it?
Well, with a bit of luck, that'll be thrown out as well.
It's a good way of shutting people up, isn't it?
It is, because it is, you know, I've got another person who works in the media, a friend, and she says the most worrying thing about it all is that there's a lot of self-censorship now. That's what's starting to happen. People decide, well, they're not going to go down that because God knows what will happen and I might lose my job or I might lose my position. And so there's a lot of self-censorship. So, you know, that Israeli propaganda Hasbara, which works across the world and particularly in the Western world, is actually working because it's shutting people down, except where people like Manette, who must have gone through a lot of trauma, psychological trauma, bringing this case to court. I have to admire her enormously.
Absolutely. And it's intuitive to say that since CR's inception in 1976, the Zionists have been after us, and they've tried many times to shut the radio station down and target, you know, journalists, but we've persevered and we're still here, and we're not going to back down either.
Good on you. And I know you wouldn't, Jan.
Haaretz. Let's move on to Haaretz. And they've been interviewing Israeli soldiers and even what role he had, but he's one of the leaders, telling the truth about what's happening at the feeding stations in Gaza.
Yes, I was just on Al Jazeera, and there's actually an article right now on Al Jazeera, and I was just reading it while we were having a little break previously, and unfortunately I didn't quite get all of what they were saying, but basically, in summary, what they are admitting to is that they are killing unarmed people and that they are allowed to kill them when they're coming for food. And so Palestinians are in the most horrific, unspeakable, horrific situation where they have to run the risk of getting killed or stay at home and be starved with their families. And why is the world so silent about this? Why is our government so silent about this when they're going through hell, absolute, unspeakable hell, just in order to feed their family? And we're seeing, even on the ABC, we're now starting to see starving children. Why are they starving? They're starving because Israel is not giving them food. And America is giving them food with the Israeli army, at the same time the Israeli army is giving permission to their soldiers to shoot anybody they feel like it who are coming up for food. Now, how can that be happening, Jan? How in God's name can that be happening? And us and our government and Penny and Albanese and the Europeans, everybody to be quiet, to stay quiet. I tell you, my stomach churns. I get so angry and upset. And I'm sure you do too. I know you do. Yeah.
Well, there's millions of people around the world who feel the same way, but we sort of feel hopeless, or we shouldn't feel hopeless, because we're the people who are standing behind the Gazans and the Palestinians. And if we give up hope...
That silly old bugger was on the television just now. The one with the red hair, if it's hair, saying that there's going to be a ceasefire in Gaza this week. The people there are suffering, they're starving. Yeah. But we've given them millions of dollars of food. The Lancet, the medical journal, The Lancet, very reputable British medical journal, came out previously and said they thought there were 250,000 people who'd been killed. The numbers of people killed that are coming out of Gaza, and everybody says the Gaza Health Ministry, at the moment, it's about 60,000. But even since they started giving food aid, they've killed 600 people. I don't know how many people they've wounded, But they've killed nearly 600 or 600 and 500 and some, you know, a very high 500 figure, whom they've actually shot dead. Just because they can. You do wonder what's going on inside the minds of those young men that can do that, the, you know, knowing that they're not fighters. But how they can do it, Jan, is because Harvard have put out another research program, and actually it's published by APAN, so anybody listening can go online and find it. And in it, it's got a wonderful map which shows very clearly that Israel now occupies 80% of Gaza, and that there are three containment areas, and this is how they came to the conclusion of the 300,000 dead, because each of these containment areas are separated, and there are military, or like there's the Netzarim corridor that the people from Gaza City would have to go through. You've actually got to go through to get to one of the feeding points. And in Gaza City, there are 1 million people. They calculated that that's how many people are still in Gaza City. And then in the other containment area, which is completely separated with military in between, it's like these three little canton areas where 1,800,000 people are pushed. So in Deir al-Bara, you've got 350,000 people. And in Mawasi, which is towards Rafah, there's 500,000 people. And with that calculation, so the previous population was 2.1 or so million. And so what they've calculated is that it's not 60,000 people that are the figures that are coming up every day on the television. No, it's 300,000. 300,000 souls have been lost since October 2003 with American bombs. Let me say it again, with American bombs, American planes, Australian spare parts for the F-triple-threes, and the viciousness and brutality of the Israeli military that one day, I hope, will be brought before the international court, and that they will have to face justice.
That's the problem, though, isn't it, Helen, that they accuse Israel of just about a war crime every day. They'll take them to the international courts, but the international courts take so long, and that's not their fault, but that's the way the process is, to actually give justice to people, not just Palestinians when they need it, but other peoples who need justice. It takes so long.
It does. I agree. It does. But in the long run, I mean, there you go. You've got a government who put the previous Prime Minister, I think, or President maybe, of the Philippines, is now sitting in The Hague. And that didn't take too long.
No.
You know, eventually they got the Serbians, eventually, because the peoples finally came to their senses and realised that what they had were these butchers and criminals who were running the country. And Netanyahu, who knows, one day Netanyahu's might end up in The Hague along with some other people, because the Israeli people have had the scales taken down off their eyes and their media lies that they've been fed. And they will face and are facing the wrath of the international community, if not the wrath of governments.
Just stay with the Philippines for a moment. Our government allowed Sara Duterte to come here and plead for her father, who's the butcher from the Philippines, and she herself was facing impeachment from government of the Philippines, yet our government allowed her to come here and try to, I suppose, raise awareness and probably raise money for his defence. He doesn't have any defence.
He doesn't. He slaughtered innocent, thousands of innocent people. Thousands.
So where does that leave our government again?
Well, our government's complicit, Jan. You know that. They're complicit in that. They're complicit in their silence over everything that's taking place in the West Bank and in Gaza. The things that everybody's been focused First, on the Israeli-Iran war. Secondly, on Gaza and the West Bank, the settlers are just going for it. They're just killing people. They're taking more land. They've practically taken over completely East Jerusalem. And, you know, nobody's covering it. Al Jazeera every now and then might put a story in, but there's just... That's another issue, that our government is completely complicit. And Penny knows for sure. She absolutely knows. She's been told it by her department. She's been told it by the heads of the international non-government agencies. You know, she's very, very well informed about what's happening. And still she refuses to, they refuse to govern, to take any action.
Well, we'll keep plugging along, Helen, and we're not going to be silenced.
No. And thank you, Jan. I do appreciate you asking me to talk, because I don't know, I'm either losing my temper or I'm crying on your show. So
I will speak to you again shortly.
Okay, Jan. Thank you.
Thank you, Helen. I've been speaking with nurse and nurse educator Helen McHugh, who in the mid-1980s established Union Aid Abroad, a feeder, and has been a lifelong supporter and worker for Palestine.
Did you know that Western Sahara is Africa's last colony? The issue of Western Sahara was raised in the Eddie Mabo case referencing Terra Nullius. Western Sahara is illegally occupied by Morocco. Indigenous Sahrawis are denied their right to self-determination. France continues to veto United Nations human rights observation in Western Sahara. Sahrawi people are being killed by Israeli drones. Like to learn more? Become informed. Become an Australia Western Sahara Association member at awsa.org.au. Australian Western Sahara Association is a 3CR supporter.
The city of Maribyrnong's population is growing. Council is asking for your feedback to help shape the future of housing in our city. Learn more, read our discussion paper and share your thoughts by 20th of July at www.yourcityyourvoice.com.au/housing. A 3CR supporter.
Now to Dr. Colin Hughes, former head of Public Health in Perth, Western Australia, and now the West Australian representative of IPAN. Let's start, Colin, with talking about Iran, Israel and the United States. And we've got
Sure. We've
got breaking of international law, we've got total hypocrisy, and we've got everything in between. So if you'd like to have a go at all that.
Well, I guess we've got to be really concerned over the last week at the unilateral action by the United States to carry out a preemptive strike on supposed nuclear facilities in Iran. This is completely in breach of international law. If we remember back to Iraq days, at least they were able to go to the United Nations and get a resolution from the United Nations before they actually started to try and find the weapons of mass destruction that actually didn't exist. It's a huge problem because clearly, although prior to the strikes that President Trump made, he only had about, I think it was about 34% support for starting a new war, after the strikes, that support went up to 63%. In other words, the American people were so convinced that there really was a threat of nuclear arms by Iran that they thought that might is right. And that now that we've got these big bunker bombing planes, maybe it's good to have a President Trump that can stop a war. To give him credit, Trump has claimed that he was being, when he was elected, that he was for peace and didn't want war and didn't want an amount of money spent on war. He actually turned around to Israel, having brokered the ceasefire between Iran, and told Israel to stop bombing. I think he used the F word. Now, that's the first time that a major Western leader has actually condemned Israel. Perhaps it augurs well for Gaza, because this week President Trump says we are imminent at getting a peace deal in Gaza. Unfortunately, his peace deals up till now have been that the Gazan people should leave Gaza and he'll create his Mediterranean of the East. Who knows what he can achieve? I guess the real issue is for Australia is that we seem to have backpedaled on our call to maintain the rule of law and international law, because Richard Marles came out and said, well, you know, we support the attacking of Iran.
With Iran, you've got Israel or America behind them, assassinating just anyone they feel like, and actually assassinating the negotiator who was trying to sort the system out.
Yes, and this is exactly the same tactic that they did to Hamas in the very early days after October the 7th. So they took out any of the negotiators and then claimed that Hamas wasn't prepared to negotiate. They've done the same thing in Iran. Very tragically, this word taken out is horrible. They have killed, they have assassinated diplomatic leaders. Now, world diplomacy cannot survive unless embassies are protected, diplomats are protected, and we respect the international rule of law. Israel is completely in breach of this. Australia, again, is silent, which is, you know, just not where we want to be as a nation. The other thing that should be remembered is that Trump presidency number one took away Obama's peace deal with Iran. Now, Obama had successfully negotiated the fact that Iran would accept the IEA, the International Atomic Energy Inspectors, and Iran was complying with that, with the Obama administration, and was only enriching uranium up to the 5% limit, which is required for medical tests and investigations. However, Trump, of course, came in and abolished that agreement, put sanctions onto Iran, and Iran perhaps mistakenly thought, well, okay, we'll crank up, certainly not to weapons grade, and certainly the director of the International Energy Agency said that they were nowhere near getting an atomic bomb. Now, let's make that quite clear. Yes, they were enriching, and yes, they had the capability, if they kept going, to create a bomb. Might have taken them months, years, who knows. But the reality was that America has trumped up this charge, again, without any idea of what's going to happen next. Like, they start a war. Trump says, well, if Iran wants to make itself great again, then they should, you know, throw over their leaders. But the world has seen what happens when you get regime change in Syria, in Iraq. We have millions of people displaced. We have a totally unstable Middle East. The Middle East certainly doesn't want this. The Middle East has one focus at the moment, and that is on Gaza. They know that Gaza is the problem in the Middle East. When the latest figures from Harvard University estimate that 377,000 people have died. Yes, 60,000 people have been taken to the morgues, killed by weapons, but another 330,000 people have died as a result of starvation, of being crushed, the lack of medical resources, and so on. I mean, this is appalling in a population of 2.1 million people. And yet the world stands by and pretends that, you know, Donald Trump has done the right thing.
And then you have Israel condemning Iran for maybe building a bomb, but Israel has had nuclear weapons for decades and refuses to acknowledge that.
Yes, Iran signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and was subject to its restrictions under the Obama legislation and deal. Israel has never signed that. We don't know how many bombs they've got, but they certainly had the scientists capable of producing them, and some people have estimated that they've got 71 nuclear warheads. The interesting thing that no journalist ever seems to ask anyone is, if nuclear arms are a deterrent, why has Ukraine attacked Russia? Why has Iran attacked Israel? Nuclear weapons don't seem to be a deterrent to non-nuclear warfare in any capability whatsoever. The reality is that if Iran dropped a bomb on Israel, the fallout from that would just, the clouds would come straight into Iran. Does no one kind of ask these questions about saying, well, Israel is the only nation on the world known to have nuclear weapons that hasn't signed a first strike agreement? The first strike agreement, even that America agrees to, is we won't send off a nuclear bomb unless you do. And if you bomb us, we'll bomb the hell out of you. And I think Trump has demonstrated that. But, you know, we've also got to realize that a few weeks before the Trump episode in Iran, the Israelis used exactly the same technique that the Ukrainians used in Russia. They loaded up a whole lot of drones inside containers, managed to ship those into Iran, strategically put them outside of their airports at a range of less than 100 kilometers, and were able to open the doors of these containers. Some of them were probably only quite small, and out came the drones and bombed the majority of the Iranian Air Force. So Iran has no capability of delivering a nuclear weapon, unlike Israel or America. So that's another issue. Journalists just don't seem to ask the right questions of our political leaders.
Well, I've thought about that a lot too, being a journalist, but I think these journalists know they're not going to get an answer. And then some of them, if they're doing an interview, they're told that if you ask the awkward questions, you won't get another chance to do an interview.
Yes, I think there's probably a lot of that, particularly in Trump's America, where he's abolished the Associated Press and the negative people that he says are not in America's interests. He's no different to what happens in Putin's Russia, where only the official sanctioned news outlets. Interestingly, in Israel, of course, they've got an independent news service in Haaretz. And they have been very critical. Millions of people have taken to the streets demanding that Netanyahu resign. The people of Israel want the hostages released. That's what they want. But again, governments that are hanging on through their authoritarianism just will cling on using anything that they need to do so.
And the really disturbing thing is that what is happening in the West Bank is being ignored virtually by the media in the West. And I'd imagine in Israel too that the people of Israel are not told what their government is doing and what the settlers are doing to the people in the West Bank.
Except that they can see what is posted by the IDF soldiers who proudly claim that they've shot kids through the head or through the chest. One child got 156 bullets pumped into her, 9 years old. And so that was on social media. The International Court of Justice, or the Criminal Court, has actually got all these videos, and they wish to take action against these individual soldiers who have posted. You know, I think Israel does know what is happening. It may not be publicly said, just like it isn't in mainstream media. But look at what happened yesterday in Glastonbury. 210,000 people reacted to the singer. Now, I cannot condone his wish to kill the IDF. But the fact that the young people of this world responded in such a positive way, they weren't saying kill all the Jews, they weren't saying, you know, kill Netanyahu, they were just saying that the IDF, who are responsible for war crimes and responsible for this Gaza genocide, should stop. And yet the news media, particularly in England, of course, has come out and said this is absolutely shocking that people should say such a thing. Where is the shock? Where is the despair that people who are seeking food from the humanitarian aid that Trump is providing, and I stress Trump is providing, protected, so-called, by Israeli forces and mercenaries, American mercenaries, and yet they've killed over 500 people since the aid started resuming. I mean, this is just appalling. Where is the concern about that in our media?
I'd like to talk a bit about the cost of war, why there is a war. It's because the money is there to facilitate war. We look at what wars over the last probably century for the United States has cost the people their taxpayers' money over that time, with the number of wars that the United States has engaged in, lost most of them, and the money, the trillions and trillions of dollars that have been spent on war.
Well, we know the Iraq war alone costs the American government and people $8 trillion. Remember, that war went on for 40 years because, you know, it started way back in 1996 but didn't finish until 2014. There were a series of Gulf War I's, Gulf War II's. That is $8 trillion that has not been spent on health and education and housing and building America. The Afghanistan war was said to cost $2.1 trillion. Again, unbelievable. $1 trillion is $1,000 billion. While America is doing this, China is investing in research and development, building their nation in productivity, in the Belt and Rail projects across the world, gaining soft diplomacy. Trump's reply to all of that, we will cut American media services in the South Pacific, which used to give kind of news of the world from an American point of view. So there's no more soft diplomacy from media, just like Australia stupidly cut the ABC Australia that used to broadcast into all of the Southeast Asian countries and the South Pacific, on the basis that it is much better to just buy another bigger, stronger plane, which certainly helps a very small percentage of the population who are working in the defence industry, and it certainly helps the big boys, the big multinationals. But what does it to people? I think the American people have got two major concerns. One is the huge amount of money that's going here, but they also don't want their American sons and daughters going off to war to fight in yet another war which cannot be won. The Middle East wars, no one wins a war in the Middle East. The tragedy of killing the fathers, brothers, sisters, daughters of anybody who's been killed in Syria, Palestine, Iraq, those children are always going to, well, not all of them, but a lot of them are going to have hate and rejection and absolute despair in their own particular lives. So he's just created another, you know, million terrorists around the world to destabilize the Middle East. Let's face it, this is the master plan of Israel. It's got nothing to do really with just Gaza. Israel has got a plan that goes back, you know, 40 years that they have to make Israel safe. By initially they took over the Golan Heights, they've now invaded Syria and have got a so-called demilitarized zone there going for a long distance. They would like to see their borders go outside of Lebanon so that they've got absolute security to a certain extent, the Israeli people believe maybe, well, that's what we've got to do to protect ourselves from the occasional bomb or the occasional stabbing. We will consider the death, the destruction of millions of people. Just makes no sense to the world.
And then you look to the future of the people of Gaza who survive this genocide by Israel, that they've been starved off and on for 17, 18 years since the blockade of Gaza. What's going to happen to those people who have been starved? What it does to their physical and their mental development over years? Who's going to look after them?
We worry about the rapid increase in ADD and autism in Australia with poor diet, and you know, give Kennedy his due. He may be able to do something about it in America. But, I mean, the situation in Gaza is appalling. We've got to remember that Gaza actually had three functioning universities, and there was a wonderful program, which I recommend to all of our listeners, on the ABC that you can watch on iView, that was on the ABC yesterday, where they interviewed Palestinian families that had arrived in Australia, people with engineering degrees and doctorates and in medicine, very clever people that had graduated from Palestinian universities. It wasn't a backward, you know, heathen state that America likes to think of it. It was a highly cultural area that the people had been living in for thousands of years. They had antiquities and mosques dating back for thousands of years that have now been completely destroyed. Interestingly, just like in Africa, where the old idea was, well, African people are black, they could not possibly be as intelligent as white people. It only takes one generation to be properly fed, properly educated, to allow the genetic material to resume. Yes, we've lost a generation of kids and the new generation coming. The Arab nations are willing with a $2.1 billion trust fund that they are ready to go in and rebuild the hospitals, rebuild the schools, rebuild the universities, rebuild the mosques. Trump will not allow that to happen. So who knows what's going to happen this week? A day is a very long time in Trump's political world.
Now, you'd also like to talk about your premier, Mr. Cook. Where's he going to?
He's just off to the UK to look at military facilities there, which are going to try and rebuild a submarine. He forgot to read the small print that said Rolls-Royce has pulled out of the development of this new nuclear power for these huge submarines. Now, they're about six times bigger than a Collins-class submarine. So they're huge underwater boats, and they need a big engine, basically, to run them. And Rolls-Royce was going to build this as part of the new Orca submarine, which was going to share technology between the US, UK, and Australia. UK's in the same problem. They haven't got enough nuclear scientists that want to work in this area. They haven't got enough tradies that have got the skills, and they have to be pretty highly technical people to do this. They haven't got enough people that want to join the military. But Roger Cook is perfectly happy for us to go over there. Like we've just given $500 million to America, we've also given similar amounts. And I think the ultimate bill to Australia is going to be $10 billion to the UK to build these AUKUS submarines. The only thing that Western Australia gets out of this is the servicing of these vessels. Why the hell UK nuclear submarines would bother to come all the way into the Pacific, into the Indian Ocean, to be serviced by Stirling Naval Base at Henderson? It's just ludicrous. And his argument to the West Australian on the front page was that we are creating 10,000 jobs, and isn't that wonderful for Western Australia? We had 10,000 jobs already. In this Henderson base, we were building world first electric ferries, these gigantic ferries, which anyone who's been to Europe and South America and so on know that these big ferries are used for transporting people and cars and so on everywhere. And we're starting to build electric ferries, right? We also build luxury yachts for people like Greg Norman with a highly skilled workforce. We were also building these huge frigates. Company called BAE, which I think is a British company, was actually building the very next frigates that were going to protect Australia's shores. The reason that they were stopped, we were meant to build seven, we'd already built two, was that they were out of date. And I'll say that again. The reason that we stopped building these seven new warships was that they were out of date. They were out of date because they could not resist undersea drones or attacks from ballistic missiles. What the hell is Australia saying that it's going to build a new fleet of submarines, which by the time they come, they will be obsolete as well? Only one third of the American fleet of nuclear submarines is in the water at any one time. They have so many problems of maintenance. You can imagine that even the slightest denaturing of the lead shields inside a submarine, which is starting to leak, means that the whole submarine has to be put into dry dock and completely refurbished, which is exactly why we're building these docks in Western Australia, because we know that that's what's going to happen. But are you going to tell me really that a submarine is going to come all the way from America, drop its ballistic missiles containing nuclear arms in Hawaii, keep coming to Australia to be refurbished, then go back in the middle of a war with China to pick up the nuclear arms that it is then going to go into the South China Sea and fire at China? This is ludicrous. Again, no one is calling it out. Biden promised that there would be no nuclear arms on any ship coming to Australia. The Australian government has chosen a policy of we will neither confirm nor deny. So Australian people are again blindsided. We have just allowed the US to unload tons and tons of military equipment in Darwin to go down to the Tyndall base where the B-52s can take off. Australia is being totally blindsided by the American Industrial Corporation.
The war on Palestine has not stopped. Palestinians need self-determination. Gaza must be free of Israeli occupation forces, have unconditional access to aid and reconstruction. 17 years of Israeli siege must end.
The West Bank needs the violence and attacks by the Israeli army and settlers to stop, and an end to the occupation and apartheid.
Your support to end the war on Gaza to bring peace, justice and freedom to all of Palestine is needed more than ever.
Converge on Canberra, 20th to the 22nd of July. Sanction Israel. Join the united call to sanction the state of Israel in response to the genocide on Palestine.
With Netanyahu and Trump threatening to ethnically cleanse Gaza and annex the West Bank, we all need to stand up and say no.
Converge on Canberra, 20th to the 22nd of July. Sanction Israel.
With your support, Palestine will be free, from the river to the sea.
Free Palestine Melbourne is a 3CR supporter.
Now to the second and final part of the conversation between Palestinian activist Ahmed Alabadla and journalists Winnie Bacon and Yukov Aran. We concluded part one with Wendy Bacon talking about Sally Sarah on ABC Radio National breakfast program, allowing Julian Siegel, Australian Special Envoy to Combat Anti-Semitism, defaming the Greens.
We can compare that to the Nasamashny example that I referred to before of just pulling down a video when he also was allowed to speak uninterrupted. But his interview gets taken down, the other one just is allowed to stay there with a small excuse. And this is how the end result, I think, of these ways of seeing the world that have too much, far too much influence on the world, get into the heads of journalists, particularly the managers of journalists.
I do want to get back to Gillian Siegel as well, but I couldn't help but picking up on something that you said. On the outside, it seems that Zionist organizations kind of align better with conservative right-wing organizations in Australia, talking about Liberal Party, Advance Australia, and, you know, even the right wing of the Labors. So how is Israel Lobby in Australia involved with these kind of far-right organizations? I mean, why do they always align?
I think the Labor Party depends, look, always with these questions does depend to some extent what we mean by right wing or left wing. There's no doubt that there's a strong, powerful Zionist lobby within the Labor Party, and the organisation I mentioned, Better Australia, is both Labor and Liberal. But on the other hand, we can say, well, they're right-wing Labor. But Yaakov mentioned before the Australian Jewish Association, which is a far-right organisation. They're anti-immigration, they're far-right on a number of issues, and they are aligned with Advance, and Advance is a far-right lobby group that played a very powerful role in The Voice. So those connections are there. But I think what to some extent has happened with the Zionist lobby and right-wing politics is not only have they got their own versions which are connected with Advance, and Australian Jewish Association has partnered with Advance, then we've got another one called the Minority Impact Coalition that's connected with the Queensland Jewish Collective, and they also, they're quite obviously connected with Advance. You know, there's specific offshoots. I don't know whether Yaakov would like to add anything to that, but it's definitely become an aspect of it. And if we take Advance, they're not stopping with the election. They claim a certain amount of influence in the election results, but I've every now and again checked what they're doing, and they're heading straight on for the next election. They've got, I think, up to 35 staff and millions of dollars. So the Zionist lobby is attached to them, and I think playing a quite a big influence probably on them as well.
I do want to get your input on this, Yaakov, but I also want you to explain to what extent is Zionism an inherently far-right ideology? Is that the right designation of Zionism?
No, it is complicated. Its current form is absolutely fascist. There's no way around that. But it is still an adaptable ideology that presents different faces at different times when it's appropriate. And its public image would not survive if it did not do this. You know, Zionism, of course, does have a fascist face that it presents, but it also has this liberal Zionist face, this indigenous liberation face where it says it's, you know, land back for the indigenous people of Israel. It's got a queer face, you know, Israel's this gay haven among the homophobic Arab world. What I find really interesting is Mark Liebler, he delivered a speech to the Jewish Community Council of Western Australia in 2018, which got leaked to John Menadue. He said that it's really important to tailor your approach. He provided a guide, his own guide for young up-and-coming lobbyists, and he said you always need to pick your message. So sure, it's got a fascist face, but you need to know when you're speaking to liberals, present the liberal face. There's a double speak of Zionism that's always there. Israel is freeing Gaza from Hamas, let's say. But then at the same time, they'll say, oh, the whole Palestinian nation is responsible. And both of these narratives exist simultaneously. But because the Zionists and Israel lobby have this anxiety of not airing dirty laundry of Jewish communal issues, of Israeli politics in public, because they feel like it's going to stoke anti-Semitism if they, you know, in any way criticize Israel publicly, you get these people who are on the same side, Zionist side, with fundamentally contradicting narratives. You can't say, well, Israel's a Jewish ethnostate and Jewish people have a right to set up a state like that, while at the same time saying, oh, Israel's a democratic state representing everyone equally. But these narratives still coexist, and they never actually fight with each other in the public eye. They just present each other to the public, to the media, when it's appropriate. So, you know, it is important to remember that Zionism was founded by people who proclaimed themselves to be socialists. You could argue whether they were real socialists or not, but, you know, colonialism was very trendy at the time in the 19th century. Colonialism wasn't thought of as a conservative thing. And of course, back then, the Zionists were very open across the board. There was no doublespeak then about whether Zionism was a colonial movement. And socialists did colonialism too. Of course, Israel could never have come into existence without a genocide. But I don't think it's fair to say that Zionism was always fascist or that leftists cannot commit fascism. This thinking leads to, you know, us to avoid self-reflection as leftists.
Do you think Zionism could also have a left-wing and more conservative side as well? I mean, we've been reading about Jabotinsky and the revisionist Zionism as well. Could that be fitting within the conservative side of this leftist movement?
What's important to understand about Zionism is because it is a movement to set up a Jewish ethnostate that doesn't represent everyone equally. There are progressive policies, but those progressive policies among Zionists and debated in Israeli parliament will only ever reach Jews, Israeli Jews, or to a lesser extent, what they call Arab Israelis, who have remained quiet because of fear of persecution about ever calling themselves Palestinians. Sure, you know, you get free healthcare there, free education, subsidized housing, but these are progressive policies if they reached everyone equally. Unfortunately, they only reach citizens who have a very particular bloodline, a Jewish bloodline.
Change gear and talk about anti-Semitism. And I want to start with you, Yaakov, as well. How authoritative have been the reports on anti-Semitism in Australia? I mean, I remember I had a conversation with Professor Peter Slezak, and we talked in length about whether it's actually credible statistics that we're hearing from predominantly Zionist organizations reporting on anti-Semitism. I also want to pile on this question. What has been the role of the special envoy on anti-Semitism? You mentioned Gillian Siegel, Wendy. So if you could give us a compact answer to that question, Yaakov.
Well, the most important thing on that question is the Executive Council of Australian Jewry publishes an annual anti-Semitism report, and it compiles all the list of incidents. None of these incidents are verified. Anyone can file a report. None of them are questioned in any sort of way. So, for example, it says that it only includes incidents which specifically target the Jewish community. So there's incidents where Christians were wearing an Israeli flag and they were targeted. And then it says, well, the abusive people, the anti-Semites, clearly assumed that they were of Jewish heritage, so it was anti-Semitic by nature. There's another one where people held a protest outside Elbert Systems office in Melbourne advocating for BDS. Okay, apparently that's anti-Semitic and made it to the register. I mean, these things are just massively inflated. There's another one. There was a sticker placed across the road from the Great Synagogue in Elizabeth Street in Sydney CBD, where, you know, across the road, there's weekly Palestine protests simply because it's the CBD. I mean, it's the biggest park in Sydney. It's the best place to hold a protest. But there was a sticker placed across the road that said, from the river to the sea, put on a street pole. Okay, that made the register as well. They only actually named about 100 of the 700 incidents. So you'd assume that they only named the most serious ones. Well, the most serious one includes a sticker across the road.
Say something here about, like, I think that Yaakov has actually written about this study, if any, well, if we could call it a study, if people want to read more detail, but I think it's really dodgy. Like, from a media point of view, if you got a survey like that, if you were doing serious journalism, you would really ask about, well, how credible is this? You know, all the things that Yaakov is raising, but the really worrying thing is the thing goes out into the sort of media sphere and is likely to turn up as if this is a credible news finding and that we all need to really take account of it. And to me, one of the problems with it is it sort of trivializes actual anti-Semitism.
I was about to ask you, Wendy, like, what impact could that have on the Jewish community? I mean, just to perpetuate that kind of living in fear?
Well, I think the living in fear thing is, well, I can't talk from personal experience, and Yaakov may want to add something here, but, you know, certainly if you put out reports, as happened with the caravan incident, and you say there's a mass terror event about to happen, could be about to happen in Sydney, that is going to spell fear into the hearts of Jewish community and other people too, for that matter. And that is itself damaging and an actual thing. Yes, the amplification of it means it has, that is a separate effect of it. So that's really worrying. You know, the fact that I don't think the Executive Council of Jury is the appropriate body to be doing this survey. I'd like to see something like the Human Rights Commission. And then, of course, everything depends on the definition of anti-Semitism. So we all get back to this, really, the heart of it, which is the criticism of Israel, or spelling out a different position, is seen as anti-Semitic. So you become an anti-Semitic person if you do that, and you can be labelled as that. And that is,
and even the selection of the envoy to anti-Semitism as well has been problematic for some.
Absolutely. I mean, do you want to say something about Julian Siegel, Yaakov? I mean, I was just shocked. When I heard that the government had appointed Julian Siegel, I thought, well, that's like appointing someone from the heart of the Zionist lobby.
Yeah, and someone who has built a career based on saying that any anti-Zionism is necessarily anti-Semitic. I mean, it's in the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance working definition that she's constantly worked to introduce the policy to workplaces and everything. With Gillian Siegel, so her husband is John Roth, who runs a property development business with his brother Stanley Roth. Stanley Roth is on the board of United Israel Appeal to this day, which, you know, is a charity worth like $50 million, constantly raising money for, quote unquote, the war effort in Israel. John and Stanley Roth's business that they run together, Hen Roth directly funds advance, $50,000. So they are directly connected to all this. And the government, the Australian government, has paid the Israel lobby to have someone in-house, literally in Parliament House, on the taxpayer dime, to advocate for Israel by saying, well, any opposition to Zionism or any advocacy for a one-state solution is anti-Semitic. With the Great Synagogue sticker that I mentioned before, both her and the Rabbi Ben Elton of Great Synagogue had very similar messages in response to this apparent targeting of the Great Synagogue. Ben Elton attended a protest together with Ophir Birnbaum in, I believe, November. He said, every single week my synagogue has been targeted by the Palestine protests. Well, no, it hasn't. I mean, there's protests across the road in Sydney's biggest park because you're in the central business district. There was a sticker. It's not threatening. To the latest New South Wales anti-Semitism inquiry, they really strongly criticised the Labor Party for passing legislation banning protests nearer places of worship, because the Labor Party explicitly refused to name a precise distance that was required, which is actually even terrible in its own way because it's vague. It means it's open to the discretion of the cop to say, well, you're a kilometre out, you're 100 metres out, you're 50 metres out. There's a Palestine protest, but there's a church nearby. There's a Church of Scientology nearby, who knows what. But Gillian Siegel advocated for 500 metres on the record. Rabbi Ben Elton, 150 metres. This is the game they're playing. That's the influence these reports have. It starts with a sticker on Sydney's busiest streets, and it ends with that.
We've been hearing, and, you know, part of the conversation I had with Professor Peter Slezak as well, about the weaponization as well of anti-Semitism, also maintaining fear in the Jewish community. How far has the Zionist lobby gone into weaponizing anti-Semitism in order to, like you mentioned, silence these protests and silence these anti-genocide activism. If you want to add a little bit to that as well, Wendy, I know one of the most prominent stories that we've heard recently was, I mean, well, there's a number of stories. The Cairo Cafe attempt to manufacture anti-Semitism. There's the Juralpa van. Could you give us some insight on that?
Just before I mention a little bit more about Ofi Birnbaum and the Cairo takeaway, just in terms of suppression of dissent and how anti-Semitism is being weaponized by the Zionist lobby, there are many people I think we could mention, but one person who it's happening to at the moment is Mary Kostakidis, who's a well-known anti-Zionist and a journalist. And, you know, for just a couple of tweets that somebody might not like, but reporting, just like Antoinette did, reporting things that people are saying, that is what journalists do. She is now being seriously taken on human rights infringements. She's ended up in the federal court. It's hugely expensive. It demobilizes her, if you like. And, you know, this is also happening to people at Sydney University. So I think we almost need a database of the impact of the lobby on the numbers of people whose lives have been affected apart from the general community. But Ofi Birnbaum is an interesting character, but I think we need to say that he was very involved with Better Australia, which has been involved with local government elections in New South Wales and now the federal elections, very much.
And that's a bipartisan kind of organisation.
Yeah, it's a bipartisan organisation. So he's on the, if you like, the Labor side. I don't know if he's still a member of the Rosebery branch of the Labor Party, but he certainly was and was reported by, just in passing, by the Sydney Morning Herald to have been in the Labor Party. His partner, Sophie Calland, is, if you like, the executive officer, the main person running the organisation, and she's also in the Labor Party. So their partner's married. Now, Ofi really drew attention to himself when he was doing this undercover so-called documentary with News Corp going off to discover anti-Semitism. Now, he ended up, there was a big scene when he got News Corp got uncovered in the Cairo takeaway. Actually, there was inaccurate versions of what exactly had happened, which made it more messy, if you like. But then Yaakov and I started looking a bit more at Ofi Birnbaum. And I mean, I think there were other people in the media, but in the non-mainstream media, I think at Crikey also working on this, we're not the only ones. But once we sort of started looking at him, the fact that he is Israeli-Australian, but the range of protests he'd been at, the speaking at rallies, he was in Never Again Is Now, is that what that organisation is called?
Yes, he's a founding organiser.
Yeah, he's a founding organiser with a man called Mark Leach, who is a far-right Christian who is also involved with Never Again Is Now. So he was connected with all these people over a period of a year. He'd been at all sorts of protests. He was down in Melbourne the very weekend before, involved with the Paran election, by-election, and then he was back up here linking up with News Corp again for his undercover activities. Now, when we exposed him, we sent questions to a person in Israel who was apparently connected with him. We never really could get to the bottom of that, but suddenly, 20 minutes after these questions went off, all social media, thousands of posts of Ofi's disappear offline, and you know, all trace was gone. Pretty much, you can find the odd picture of him, and we'd published pictures anyway. Now, he cropped up again. He was there all the time. He was working on the Better Australia campaign for the federal election, and he was up in the seat of Richmond on election day at Ocean Shores handing out leaflets saying the Greens are terrorists, that sort of thing. So, you know, he might be quiet now, but he's still a factor. And I think what is most interesting about him, because he's not the only person like that, but is the range of different strategies that he is deploying over a period of time to spread the message of anti-Semitism, if you like, accusing everybody else of being anti-Semitic. He's also done undercover filming of protests and of the Greens. And so that's just a little bit. And I think really the most interesting thing for now is, what does it tell us about how the Zionist lobby is working? I think, Yaakov, I might hand over to you now, because it's easy to dismiss these people. And I think people do this a little bit. So, oh, they're just these trolls. But Yaakov, would you just like to add something to who he keeps company with? And
yeah, Ophir Birnbaum, it's very easy to underestimate him. Wendy and I uncovered, it was really Wendy, that Better Australia was actually taking advice from some really important people. Yaron Finkelstein, who was previously the secretary to Scott Morrison, Eric Rosendahl, who was the former treasurer of New South Wales Labor, involved in quite a few different scandals implicating that he may have been corrupt. And of course, both of these guys served in the New South Wales Jewish Board of Deputies in very senior positions at the same time. But what we realized when we found these documents is that actually this was really a roundtable meeting with very important people, and everyone there has earned their spot. You know, just because Ophir trolls people with, you know, Looney Tunes theme songs in the background, it doesn't mean this guy is as hopeless as he might be assumed to be. You know, Looney Tunes is not the soundtrack to this guy's life. He meets with major players. It's fair to say that now that Ophir Birnbaum and Sophie Calland are major players in the Israel lobby.
And one other person you could mention, just to show those, I guess, cross-party ties, is there's a person called Alex Poulsen, who was involved with Sophie Calland from the very beginning. And he is a Liberal Party Zionist who worked for Simon Birmingham, who was a senator, recently retired. I should just say about Rosendahl that he's the patron of Labour Friends of Israel and quite a significant figure. He did step down from the New South Wales government and was before ICAC, but ICAC found that he was not corrupt, and he subsequently re-entered the Labour Party. But he certainly was involved in scandals.
There is a natural marriage between these organisations, like what Ophir Birnbaum and Sophie Calland were doing, like the Minority Impact Coalition, Queensland Jewish Collective, in the way that they're doing Hasbara, this, you know, so-called non-political advocacy for, you know, Jews' right to self-determination in their homeland or whatever it is they say it. All apparently non-political. You get volunteers on the booth saying, we were asked to sign up to defend Israel. There's this natural marriage between them and these groups like Institute of Public Affairs, Center of Independent Studies, the groups above that. They're all tied to this international network called the Atlas Network, where billionaires will fund these junk think tanks that just pump out like fast food studies. There's zero credibility to it, but people think, oh, it's a think tank. It's kind of academic, isn't it? Well, it's not. And they'll pretend to be champions of freedom and liberty and old school liberals, centrists, but really it's just a way for billionaires to pump money into a think tank so that they can launder their political ideology, which is really most of the time just whatever makes them an extra $1 billion. Increasingly, that's becoming the war machine. The military-industrial complex realizes, well, we can increase our net worth by funding these think tanks. And that means Hasbara, that means Zionism. When before, really, big coal mining was sent to place. And so when these groups say, oh, we're just traditional liberals and centrists, it presents their politics as not really, oh, we're not advocating for tax evasion. We're not advocating for less income tax for billionaires. We're advocating for common sense. And it's naturally morphed into Hasbara. Now what you have is the Israel lobby joining this pile on. Originally it was just the AJA opposing the Greens. Now you have the entire Israel lobby joining the pile on. And they fired warning shots against Labour as well by saying, you know, put the Greens last. But there was a call not just for voters to put the Greens last, but also for Labour Party preferences. So when Labour failed to do this, they were painted as Greens light. This was an anti-Labour campaign ran by the entirety of the Israel lobby. together with AJ and other far-right groups.
You've been listening to the second part of a conversation between Ahmed Alabadi, Palestinian activist in Sydney, and journalists Wendy Bacon and Yugov Aran. The title of the talk was Promoting Israel in Australia, the Influence of the Israeli Lobby in Australian Politics and Media.
Because the Palestinian fight isn't just the Palestinians' fight, it's all our fight, because it's a fight not just about land, it's about a fight for freedom.
Everybody should be standing here today saying, Free Palestine.
Solidarity with our Palestinian brothers and sisters on behalf of the Gumbanja Nation, my people who've never ceded their sovereignty.
We should be recognising Palestine as a state and recognising the rights of Palestinians.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
In the past 2 months, many people in the world have been holding their breath as nuclear-powered nations engage in conflicts. First, it was India and Pakistan, and second, Israel and the US, with preemptive strikes against Iran. But where does the world stand in the likelihood of a nuclear war? And is nuclear war now, rather than climate crisis, humanity's biggest threat? Yesterday, I spoke with Associate Professor Tilman Ruff about the consequences should a war break out, and asked him to compare the nuclear weapons we have today to the nuclear weapon that were exploded by the US in Japan in 1945.
Well, of course, the physics of what nuclear weapons do hasn't changed, and they're devastating weapons, both in terms of their size and also in their unique characteristics, especially the radiation effects and their effects as sort of incendiary devices is really unparalleled. But the Hiroshima-sized bomb, even though it was about 15,000 tons of high explosive equivalent, you know, the largest conventional bombs are 1,000 times less than that, the very large bombs that the US dropped on Iranian nuclear facilities recently were about 13 tons of high explosive equivalent. So we're talking 1,000 times bigger than that. There are no small nuclear weapons. The Hiroshima bomb and the slightly bigger Nagasaki one at about 21,000 tons of high explosive equivalent. By today's standards, they're small tactical size nuclear weapons. The smallest weapons in the arsenals of nations now are about that size, and the average size is more like 170,000 tons of high explosive equivalent, and there's still bombs that are 5 million tons of explosive equivalent. So I guess that's the first difference. The bombs now are very likely to be bigger. But also, at that time of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings, you know, there were only two nuclear weapons in the world, and they were both used. So there was no possibility of nuclear escalation. But these days, all of the evidence from military strategy, from exercises, from the experience of when we've come close to nuclear weapons being used, all of the advice from those who've managed nuclear weapons tells us that if that threshold is crossed again, that nuclear weapons are used, then it's extremely likely that it will escalate to further nuclear use. It will escalate quickly and pretty much uncontrollably, you know, within a matter of sort of minutes and an hour or two. The scenario of, you know, one or two, a small number of nuclear weapons, defined area with an outside world that still exists and can come and help and that doesn't induce major global effects like nuclear winter and nuclear famine, is very much an unrealistic scenario in the modern world. That's not what a modern nuclear war would look like. It's likely to escalate very quickly and rapidly. So that, unfortunately, is the reality that we're in now.
And what would a nuclear winter and famine look like?
Well, I think these are the most important scientific findings of the last couple of decades, the understanding from really robust climate science that now is, you know, pretty good, and lots of different models and different studies by different groups of scientists have shown pretty much the same thing. Nuclear weapons are extremely efficient at igniting fires, and there's a lot of flammable stuff in the world, especially in our cities now. All the petroleum products, the oil and gas, the petrol in cars, the heating oil, all of the plastics, all of the vegetation and wood and textiles and paper products, asphalt, all of that will burn. Even the relatively small bomb in Hiroshima is thought to have released about 1,000 times as much energy in the fires that it started as in the explosive power of the bomb itself, which is, of course, was already very large. Essentially, you can set a whole modern city alight for over 1,000 square kilometres pretty much instantly in coalescing fires with nuclear explosions. That would put millions of tons of sort of sooty black smoke, much more and more and blacker smoke than from forest fires, into the upper atmosphere. It would get rise very high into the stratosphere. It would there, because it's black, it would get hot. The stratosphere would get very hot, deplete ozone really quickly. That protects us from ultraviolet radiation. And that dark, cloudy blanket would spread around the world and persist for over a decade, even if a nuclear war just happened in one part of the world, involving as low as 100 or 200 nuclear weapons, you know, even just 1 or 2% of the global nuclear arsenal. So underneath that black cloud, the physics is really straightforward and simple and has been robust for decades. If you block out the sun, it's going to get cold and dark and dry underneath, to the extent that the temperatures would plummet to essentially the lowest temperatures that we had during the last ice age about 20,000 years ago, which were between 3 and 8 degrees colder than now. So you would have those conditions essentially created within a day. That would decimate agriculture, particularly in the higher latitudes where most of the world's grain is grown, and that would also persist for many years. So we're talking about even a relatively small war, such as could happen if Israel's nuclear weapons were used or those in India and Pakistan, then you're talking about a global climate catastrophe that could put up to 2 billion people or even more at risk of starvation just in the first couple of years, even if their countries are distant from the conflict and had nothing to do with it. The effects are not localized in any sense. And you know, I think the best analogy is really that these are global suicide bombs. You just can't use these. These are not targetable in any legal or militarily useful way. That's unfortunately the reality that would be likely to follow any of the most plausible scenarios for nuclear war these days. The idea that you could use a couple of new tactical nuclear weapons somewhere, as was sort of canvassed in the early part of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, that countries could launch a demonstration shot or two to prove their serious intent and deter the other side. The risks of either of those leading to rapid escalation are in fact extremely high. So that's in fact a very unlikely scenario for how war would evolve if that nuclear threshold is crossed.
Yet we now have 9 countries who have those weapons, even though over the years they've been able to limit the number in a number of countries. You've got to get rid of the whole lot. It's not just getting rid of a couple of hundred.
Yeah, that's right. We have made substantial progress. The number of nuclear weapons in 1986 was just over 70,000, and it's now just over 12,000, unfortunately going up again for the first time in more than 30 years. But it's still, there's so much destructive capacity there that it could still end the world relatively easily, many times over, really. We're not really safe from that sort of nuclear winter and famine scenario until we're down with much lower numbers, like hundreds, tens of nuclear weapons. Of course, it's going to be much easier to verify and sustain a world free of nuclear weapons than it is a world with nuclear weapons around, with this constant risk and danger of them being used. The presence of nuclear weapons anywhere is really the most potent driver of proliferation. other countries wanting to get them. If they feel threatened by states with nuclear weapons, you know, as well they might. Countries have used Israel and the US in Iran just very recently, as Russia is doing in Ukraine, have used the threat of their nuclear arsenals as cover to get away with illegal aggressive actions. It provides them with sort of impunity to intervene militarily much more aggressively than they otherwise could. So the message in all that is that you're better off with nuclear weapons. You know, the dangerous driver in all of that is that what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And if you follow the logic of nuclear deterrence to its logical conclusion, then every nation should have nuclear weapons because, you know, if deterrence works, then everybody should benefit from it. If it's really a stabilizing thing, unless you actually get rid of all of them, there's the constant danger and incentive to proliferate and the risk of their use. We simply have to get rid of them. That's the only viable long-term solution.
Can you detail the efforts over those decades to try and stop the production of nuclear weapons and to get rid of the ones that are already there? Is it a United Nations task? Are there bodies within the United Nations who have taken on this course?
Yes, very much so, Jan. It's, you know, the United Nations was founded in 1946 in the aftermath of the worst war in history to date, and to protect humanity from the scourge of war. That was its primary reason. And the very first resolution that it passed in January 1946 in San Francisco was to propose a plan for the control and elimination of atomic weapons. So this has been really core UN international peace and security business since the very founding of the UN. And it's been a constant subject of discussion and effort in that global body. The UN is the custodian, sort of holds and manages the implementation of a number of important international treaties. The United Nations also has a couple of bodies dedicated to negotiating disarmament instruments, especially the Conference on Disarmament. But the problem with the UN is that primary sovereign entity, the political power in the modern world, rests with nation states. If they want to thumb their nose at the UN, then they can and do. You know, we don't have the kind of international enforcement mechanisms that we need. The Security Council, which is the one United Nations body that can intervene and exercise military force to control actions that are contrary to the UN Charter, which excludes making war except when it's clearly defensive, the Security Council is dominated by the five first nuclear-armed states, those who won the Second World War, France, UK, China, US, and then Soviet Union, now Russia, who have, of course, have veto rights. And we've seen those nations, particularly the US and Russia, being among the most flagrant and frequent violators of the UN Charter in their recent actions, respectively, on multiple fronts. So the problem is that those to whom those powers are entrusted are essentially using it as a political tool, as an extension of their nation-state interests rather than common interests. And that is going to be very difficult to change, and it really means we probably need to work around it. The other problem is that a lot of the UN mechanisms, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is sort of the key international instrument that sort of regulates nuclear matters, like the Conference on Disarmament, which is the, as I mentioned, is the UN body that negotiates disarmament treaties, they work by consensus. Consensus sounds good. You know, we're all trying to agree. Sounds like a happy thing. But the problem is that there is very rarely unanimous agreement. And so the requirement for consensus becomes essentially a recipe for either no agreement or for agreements which are absolutely rock bottom, you know, lowest common denominator, very low ambition, often ineffectual. And the UN, of course, is strapped for funds and resources, and a lot of its important mechanisms like the Non-Proliferation Treaty have no means to implement it. You know, there's nobody whose day job it is really to implement that treaty. It's not like the Chemical Weapons Convention that has, you know, a proper secretariat with a couple of hundred people working to implement the treaty and promote compliance with it. The nuclear treaties essentially don't have that. So most of them have been outside the UN. In fact, most of them have been US and Soviet Union, then Russia agreements. And of course, there are the other important agreements, the regional nuclear weapons free zones, treaties that agree a nuclear weapon free zone. There's quite a number of them in Latin America, in Africa, in Central Asia, in Southeast Asia, in the South Pacific, you know, that have more than 110 countries as members. Those make important contributions, but of course they don't deal with the weapons that exist. So the UN is an absolutely vital collective body, you know, to address complex global problems that are increasingly intertwined, but it's really hamstrung by the political power that nations invest in it, its resources and structural ones.
And where does the International Atomic Energy Agency fit into the scheme of things?
Well, that was really a product of the promotion of so-called peaceful uses of nuclear energy in the 1950s and then the conclusion of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So the NPT, as it's typically abbreviated, was a deal made in 1968, entered into force in 1970, where the five states that had nuclear weapons then, the ones I've named, agreed in binding legal language to get rid of their weapons. No time frame or process attached, but they promised they'd get rid of them in exchange for the rest of the world not acquiring weapons. And the sweetener for those who were foregoing acquisition of nuclear weapons, assistance, encouragement and assistance with peaceful uses of nuclear technology. So the NPT has both a non-proliferation aspect and a disarmament obligation. To implement the non-proliferation part of the treaty, the IAEA was set up and its safeguards regime. So the safeguards regime is supposed to provide assurances and monitoring and transparency and accountability about countries' national nuclear programs to ensure that they're not on the path to weapons. If they are, there's nothing the IAEA can do about it, apart from refer them to the Security Council or the General Assembly. But at least it's a mechanism where there is some, you know, we know what's going on and there's an incentive for countries to do the right thing and a check on what they're doing. But fortunately, any determined state can acquire nuclear weapons, and there have been three states, Israel, India and Pakistan, who have acquired nuclear weapons who never joined the NPT. They said this is a discriminatory regime, we're not joining it, was the reason for India and Pakistan not joining it. And then North Korea was developing a nuclear weapons program and then gave 3 months' notice and left the treaty when it was fairly far advanced, as countries are entitled to leave treaties. It's always limited and can be usurped by unilateral national actions. But it has helped over the years because apart from those four, all of the world's other states have joined it. It is an important place where there is a binding legal obligation for disarmament. I think it's pretty widely recognised that lots of countries, including Australia, but Japan and Korea and Sweden and Germany and many, many countries that have flirted with nuclear weapons and have had nuclear weapons programs in the past, abandoned them as the NPT developed. And we have certainly fewer nuclear armed states now than we would have without the NPT. But has it progressed disarmament? No, it has utterly failed. Or the five states, nuclear armed states in that treaty have utterly failed after more than half a century to really in any way get serious about their disarmament obligation.
You're listening to Associate Professor Tilman Ruff, and this is 3CR, Tuesday home time. Well, into this mix comes the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Can you talk about that for a while and how successful that has been in pushing the issue of prohibition.
Yes, this nuclear weapons ban treaty was negotiated at the UN General Assembly in 2017, and it entered into force in 2021 when 50 states had ratified it. It's a really important treaty. It breaks new ground in a whole range of ways on the nuclear front. International law is not a magic wand, unfortunately, but this is an absolutely essential building block for achieving nuclear disarmament and achieving and sustaining a world free of nuclear weapons. And it fills in very notable gaps in the NPT, which is essentially an apartheid system. You know, nuclear weapons are okay for some or temporarily, supposedly temporarily, and, you know, others are supposed to forego them. The ban treaty now has 94 states signed up to it, so nearly half the world. 73 of those have ratified it, so now are formally bound by its provisions. They include pretty much all of the independent states of our region, both the Pacific Island countries, very strong supporters, New Zealand, pretty much all of Southeast Asia, with the exception of Singapore. And among the most recent ratifications late last year were Indonesia, importantly, and Solomon Islands. So we stick out, Australia sticks out not having joined it. But what does it actually do? Well, unlike the NPT, it actually provides the first comprehensive and categorical prohibition on nuclear weapons. You can't build them, test them, deploy them, share them, host them, have anything to do with them under this treaty. That's important. It establishes that clear benchmark. You can't assist or encourage anything that's prohibited by the treaty. The second thing it does is provides the only framework for actually how we actually get rid of these weapons. Of necessity, it's a broad framework. It doesn't have all of the detail that the various nuclear armed states will need, the finely negotiated step-by-step measures to get rid of their programs when they eventually decide to do so, and that'll need to be different for each of the nine nuclear programs. But it has a very robust framework that includes plans that are subject to international agreement, time-bound, verified by an independent international authority, that dismantle not just the weapons but the facilities and programs that produce them, and that then become subject to a very high level of safeguards that will provide assurance that they don't get reconstituted. And it's the only place where there is any clear international agreement for how we actually progress the elimination of these weapons. And that process is quite flexible. States can either get rid of their weapons first and then join the treaty, or they can join the treaty and then get rid of their weapons within a 10-year extendable timeframe. So it provides flexibility around that. The third thing that it does that's quite new in the nuclear field is that, like the cluster munitions and landmines bans that Australia has joined, commendably, unlike the US, it provides for the assistance of the victims of those weapons, so the victims of nuclear use and testing. So states that join the treaty have to help cooperate internationally to assist those survivors, and also to try and remediate environments that have been contaminated by nuclear weapons. That work is early days, but it's progressing, and it will make sure that those long-term legacy issues about recognition and justice and compensation and cleanup and care don't get sort of swept under the carpet as they too often have been. And it actually strengthens the international safeguards regime, not as much as some of us would like, but it does actually provide some strengthening of the regime. You can't go backwards on safeguards commitments under this treaty, which otherwise is not prohibited, for example. It's a pretty important instrument, and, you know, it helps to sort of fill in the jigsaw as to the building blocks that we need to get to disarmament and then to sustain it. But it also has a scientific advisory group. It's the only international nuclear weapons-related treaty that has a dedicated group of scientists that support the states joining the treaty and give them advice about how to implement it best. And it's working very well. It's a very collegial, unlike everything else in this space, it's very positive, it's very collegial. Civil society and affected communities have a voice at the table. it really is the only good news on the nuclear weapons front at the moment. Every nation should join it as soon as possible.
What would it take to get Australia to join?
The ducks really should be lined up for Australia to join. What it needs is political courage and leadership. That's the missing ingredient, and that needs to come from the Prime Minister. That's basically the nub of it. It's been a national policy platform commitment for Labor since 2018. It's been reaffirmed at two national conferences since. It's been supported by the Prime Minister and Foreign Minister. The government has taken baby steps towards joining the treaty, has observed, attended as an observer at the meetings of states parties, has dropped its opposition to it formally at the United Nations, has commended the way that the treaty can help give impetus to disarmament efforts, but we haven't seen any movement towards signature. It really would be the most significant thing that Australia could do to try and prevent nuclear war, to push disarmament forward, support the international rule of law, and to become part of the solution and not part of the problem of nuclear weapons risks, which we currently are, because we host facilities that play a key role in nuclear targeting and communications in Pine Gap and Northwest Cape. And increasingly, we're potentially hosting launch platforms for nuclear weapons if the US under Trump puts nuclear weapons back on surface ships and attack submarines, then that will become an issue for Australia. And the B-52s that are planned to be on permanent rotation, i.e. effectively stationed at Tyndall Air Base in the Northern Territory, the government hasn't excluded the nuclear-capable B-52s from those arrangements, which they could easily do. What we need to do is to sign the treaty, indicate our intent, and then begin a process of negotiation with the United States to end those practices that are inconsistent with the treaty, i.e. that support and assist possible nuclear weapons use. And we know that that is easily feasible because other US allies, for example, New Zealand and Thailand and the Philippines, have joined the treaty, the ban treaty, and have had no disruption. Nobody's mentioned that it's been any issue, including the US, in their non-nuclear military cooperation with the US. We could do the same. At the moment, it's the only nuclear disarmament treaty that's applicable to us that we haven't joined. And it's the only one of the treaties that ban unacceptable weapons, indiscriminate and inhumane weapons like biological and chemical weapons and cluster munitions and landmines and blinding lasers. It's the only one of those that we haven't joined. And of course, they're the worst weapons of mass destruction. So we need to do that. It's strongly supported by the public in Australia. It's supported by three quarters of the Federal Labor Caucus and most of the crossbench. It's time for the Prime Minister now returned with a resounding majority, with an increasingly dysfunctional and unreliable ally in the United States, an increasing need to, you know, assert our independence and sovereignty in our own interests to join this treaty.
Finally, Tillman, what are your major concerns about the situation in the Middle East today, and what would you want to see happening?
Well, it's a big question, Jan, but I think that this sort of temporary ceasefire, or this ceasefire that's now in place between Israel and Iran, is of course extremely welcome, but I think its future is very uncertain and fragile. Just this morning, the Israeli Defense Minister is reported as contemplating further strikes on Iran and suggesting that they might be initiated even for defensive capabilities, aircraft, missile developments, as well as nuclear developments that they've already specifically targeted. These actions by Israel and the United States not only were illegal and contrary to international law and the Charter, these were not self-defense. There was no evidence that Iran was in any way an imminent threat to either of them. These were aggressive, illegal acts contrary to the UN Charter. And they were also intensely hypocritical. You could hardly imagine a worse example of double standards, where two nuclear-armed states, Israel, the only nuclear-armed state in the Middle East, has never joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty, unlike Iran, doesn't have safeguards or IAEA inspectors, unlike Iran, is claiming the right to attack another state. And the only reason we are in this terrible, unstable situation that could result any day in further escalation again, and potentially worse escalation, is that President Trump, on his first presidential term, walked away from a remarkable and effective agreement, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, that was constraining Iran's nuclear program and putting the most stringent restrictions and safeguards on any country's nuclear program that has ever been implemented. And it was working for 3 years that the treaty was allowed to operate. Every 3 months, the International Atomic Energy Agency said Iran was fulfilling its obligations. The US walked away from that for no logical reason and has replaced it with nothing now except aggressive attacks and the law of the jungle and might. In doing so, it is not just jeopardizing Iran's future of the people of Iran and risking wider war in the Middle East. But it's also really dealt a body blow to diplomacy, to international law, to the non-proliferation regime. The lesson from this, and it may well be that Iran is already taking this lesson, that it actually now tips Iran into resolve to actually develop nuclear weapons as the only way of defending against this kind of aggressive military action. The Middle East desperately needs a comprehensive peace agreement that addresses the security of its people and nations across the board. There's some really good building blocks to build on. There have been annual meetings now for a number of years where all of the 22 Arab states have pretty impressively agreed on the framework for a zone free of mass destruction in the Middle East. It's really only the US and Israel that have boycotted those negotiations, but that provides a really good basis on which to work. I mean, Iran and Egypt were the two nations that decades ago, in 1984, were the first to propose a weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East. The current aggression really just exacerbates tensions and instability and really is the law of the jungle. You're not going to be able to achieve peace and security and non-proliferation by illegal unilateral bombings. Iran's part or any other nation's part negotiating with the US, these recent intervention, what looks like it was almost deliberately designed, it may well have been, to sabotage and circumvent the negotiations that were proceeding between the US and Iran. I mean, how can you possibly want to attack a country in the midst of negotiations with them if you expect those negotiations to progress and succeed? For Iran and any other nation negotiating with the US, how could you possibly trust any agreement that this US regime might enter into? It's really a very dangerous situation. It's really disappointing, I have to say, that Australia has fallen in to support yet another illegal act of US aggression for a country that doesn't have nuclear weapons. You know, it has so many shades and so much repetition from the Iraq debacle of decades ago. Australia should dissociate itself from this illegal, aggressive, counterproductive, destabilizing action and should ensure that we're not part of any future escalation, that the US is very clear that B-2 or B-52 bombers that are on missions to the Middle East are not welcome in Australia with support or landing or refueling. We should end cooperation, military cooperation and exchange with the Israeli government. We should really distance ourselves from this kind of law of the jungle military aggression by powerful states completely illegally and hypocritically. And we should join the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons.
Thank you so much, Tillman.
Thanks, Jen.
I've been speaking with Associate Professor Tillman Ruff, Board Member of Australian Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, and Australian Chair and Co-Founder of ICANN, and much more.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.